came in here, and so it's around like saying he organized this for this invitation. And it's like invitation for many reasons. And maybe the most important one is that this conference brings together two fields in Czech being somehow working, field of quantum information theory and the field of condensed matter theory. When coming originally work on quantum information theory, but nevertheless during the last 5 or 10 years, the people in quantum information theory are trying to use the mathematical and theoretical techniques developed in the field to write down and to express properties of many body systems. And this is what my talk is going to be about. So in fact, we'll talk about families of states, matrix product states, and what we call projected entangled pair states, and how in these families of states, which have the motivation in quantum information, when you can aim it.
Not only describing efficiently many body systems, like ground state, thermal states of many body systems, but also to understand the physical properties that emerge in those systems. And my talk actually will give you a tour on some of the things that we have been doing in this context during the last year or so. And I will start with making an introduction. So introducing these matrix product states and PEPs. I think that many of you know already these things, so this will be just some few words to recall it. Okay, so we are interested now in many body systems, so let's start considering n-spins. So that here are in a row, but they could be in the lattice or forming any other structure. And describe the state and describe the physical properties of many body system is nothing else from the mathematical point of view as working with tensors. And that's very clear because if we write the state representing our system in terms of some basis, the spin basis, then it's completely characterized by the coefficients of the state on this basis. And this is nothing else but a tensor which has many components. So this is something that I will represent in this form. It's a tensor in which has all these indices corresponding to the elements of the state in this basis of spin of a spin. And if I write an observable, then I can also write it in this basis. So it will be another tensor, which will have some other indices, so the indices corresponding to the brass and the indices corresponding to the cats. And calculating expectation value is nothing else than calculating the expectation value between x, psi, and psi, something like that. And this is just a contraction of these tensors. Okay, so that's a way of talking. So if we want to describe systems and physical properties of many body systems, then we can do it in terms of tensors if we write things just in a basis. Now, the problem that one encounters is that, of course, these tensors, if they have many indices, so you have many particles, so the number of indices is equal to the number of particles that you have, a number of spins, you have many, then become huge objects. So you have 100 particles, then and each of them is a spin 1/2, then all these tensors will have 2^100 coefficients, and there is no way that we can store these coefficients, and there is no way that we can do these contractions with these coefficients. And this is why people are looking at ways of simplifying this picture. And the idea is to represent these big tensors in terms of small tensors, which are contracted in some appropriate way. So this would be an example in which sometimes maybe you can write these big tensors in terms of the smaller tensors, so one per spin, for example. And now these tensors will still have these indices in the spin basis, but they can also be contracted according to some other indices. And in general, this is always possible. The problem is that these indices, these extra indices that this tensor have, can have very big dimensions. And so what we are interested in is in states in which these tensors have very small dimensions. So the number of indices of each tensor that appears there is very small. Just to give you an example would be the trivial case in which you have a product state. So you would have a product state of your system, then this tensor would be equal, yes, to the product of rank one tensor. So there will be no connection. There will be no contraction between these other tensors. So you'll have just these balls, and that's very simple. So then, because we don't need 2^n coefficients to express a product state, but we need just of the order of n coefficients. And now if there are not product states, then you can substitute this by small tensors with more indices, but each of the indices ranging from 1 to some value, D, capital D. And then what you gain is that instead of working with tensors which have many coefficients, so if D is the dimension of the Hilbert space of each of the spins, instead of having d to the power n coefficients, then you will work something with the number of coefficients will be proportional to n, to the number of spins, because you will specify completely the state by specifying these small tensors. So there are n of those tensors. Each of these tensors has a physical index, the spin index. So this has dimension d and has certain other indices, for example, 4. And each of them goes from 1 to d. So the number of parameters will scale like n. So as long as this d stays small, this is you can handle this system. Okay, so this is the idea of actually what people call tensor network states or tensor product states, which is the states in which, written in a basis, you can write in terms of small tensors. And just by specifying few tensors and just contracting them, you can get the properties of the whole state. So let me give you some examples. So the simplest example is matrix product state. And these are the states in which each you substitute, so each of the spin, it's now kind of characterized by a three-index tensor. And so this is what you write here. So you see, this would be like the physical index. And these are tensors that are contracted. So you can write these coefficients, in general, for a matrix product state as a trace of product of matrices. So you see, this is for each value of this index, or the spin index. Then you have a matrix with two indices, which are contracted. So this coefficient is nothing else, the product of matrices, which is traced upon. And of course, if I specify these matrices, if I specify these indices, these tensors, then I have all the information about the state. And so the number now of coefficients that I have to give you in order to represent a matrix product state is not d to the power n, but is just smaller, so the order of n times d squared times d. So it's much smaller. And actually, if your state is translational invariant, if you have a homogeneous system, then all these tensors will be equal. And then with just one tensor, small tensor, with few coefficients, you represent the whole state. And just by concatenating, just by putting it together, then you can build the properties of this state. Actually, these matrix product states have a long history. So they appear for the first time in the papers by Vanier in the 40s, in which he was doing some variational calculations in one-dimensional systems. Later on, they appear also in the papers by Affleck, Kennedy, Lieb, and Tashaki, where they show that actually there is a Hamiltonian for one-dimensional system, which has a matrix product state. They didn't call it like that, but as a ground state. So it's an exactly solvable model in a paper by Fannes, Naftengale, and Werner. Then they study the mathematical properties of these tensors, language, somehow. And in this paper by Klumpe, Schaffschneider, and Zitart, they also reinvented a little bit these tensors, and they call it matrix product states. Actually, in this paper, they call finally correlated states. But anyway, all these things are the same. What it's more important is that actually, independently, in the same year where these papers were written, so Steve White developed a method for describing one-dimensional system numerically called density matrix renormalization group. And 4 years afterwards, then Oslund and Rommel realized that actually this method of DMRG was based on matrix product state. So one could understand this method as a variational formulation in terms of matrix product state. So you give me a Hamiltonian, and I want to calculate the ground state. I may approximate it within the family of matrix product states. And if I minimize the energy as a function of these tensors, then I will find what are the tensors that give you the energy. And this is nothing else than DMRG, just written in this language. So in quantum information theory, they appear first, I think, that in the paper by Giffre in the year 2003, where he was studying so how difficult it is to simulate a quantum computation. And he showed that if you have very little entanglement somehow present, then you should be able to simulate it classically. And then he didn't call matrix product state, but the paper is written in terms of this matrix product state. And later on, with Frank Verstraeten and Martin Delgado, we studied now some many-body entanglement properties of systems, something that we call localizable entanglement. And we realized that this localizable entanglement was very difficult to compute, except if you would have a state of this form, also matrix product state, in which case you could calculate this property very efficiently. So what is more important about this matrix product state, actually, is that one can prove, one can show that under certain conditions, indeed, they describe ground states of one body, of one dimensional systems. And in the sense that, yes, with the small tensors, so by having that the number of parameters only grows polynomially with the number of particles of spin that you have, so these D parameters that I wrote there only grow linearly or quadratically with the number of particles that you have, then you can prove that any ground state of one-dimensional system with short range interactions under certain conditions then can be described by that. So this shows that in one dimension, actually, typically you will not need an exponential number of parameters to find the ground state, but just with few parameters, just if you specify these tensors, then everything will be describable. And this is what we show through in terms of the area laws. So what we show in this paper is that if you fulfill an area law or even violations of the area law for the entropy in one dimension, logarithmic corrections for the area law in one dimension, then you're sure that there will be a matrix product state that will be close to the state that violates this area law or fulfills the area law. That's written here. So for states which fulfill this, I believe to be true, one-dimension area law, then matrix products provide an efficient description of the systems, and then Matt Hastings proved it for gap Hamiltonians. You have a one-dimensional system with short-range interactions, and your Hamiltonian is a gap, then you're sure that you will be able to describe the ground state or approximate as much as you want with a matrix product state in which the number of parameters grows polynomially with the number of spins. Yeah?
Whether metropolitan state is useful or in which sense is useful?
Well, if you would have logarithm, so you have a ground state of a gapless system which violates the area law logarithmically, you can still prove that the matrix product state will approximate the state and the number of parameters only grows polynomially, the number of particles, not exponentially. This was shown in the paper that I mentioned before.
Oh, I see. So you like this internal dimension only to grow polynomially with the system size.
Exactly. They only grow polynomially with the size.
Yeah. There are also these theorems that I don't fully understand about 1D systems being QMA complete, even with short range interactions.
That's right. Sometimes, yeah. Yes. There is a question. Sorry, I will come to that later on. So there's not the reason for one thing. Is that they can be described efficiently. Mm-hmm. The second question is whether you can find this description. These are two different questions. For example, a spin glass, I mean, can be described as a product state, the ground state of a spin glass.
Even for translation invariant system, that's restrictive.
Okay, yes, but this is, you can put the parameters, I think that maybe Daniel talks about that. In this,
well, I'm not getting it far. Thank you.
Okay. anyway, so.
There's a question, but you were going to talk about the QMA.
No, I'm not going to talk about that.
Okay.
But anyways, we'll come later on. Maybe, so.
Okay. Anyway, those are also gapless systems. So not all gapless systems have to have the logarithmic growth.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I think that's maybe the...
Yes. So the claim is if it has logarithmic growth, then you can represent it, you can approximate it by matrix for that sake. Because the next question is what happens now in higher dimensions, so in two dimensions. And then you can do basically the same thing. So now you have two-dimensional system. Instead of putting your tensors aligned on a row, you can align according to the lattice. In this form, so for example, in the square lattice, now you will have that there will be a rank 5 tensor. So there will be a physical index, like the spin index, like before. And now they will be contracted with respect to these indices here. So just by giving you a tensor with these 5 indices, then I completely describe the whole state. And how do you build a state? You have these two contracted tensors. So again, you have translational invariance, then this tensor will always be the same. You can show that, and you can choose them all the same. So it means that all the physical properties of your system are contained in a tensor. And the physical properties emerge when you concatenate it, but in principle, this tensor contains all the physical properties because you can calculate with it all the expectation values. So actually, in this paper of AKLT, already an example of a state like that appear in two dimensions. Now, in the context of DMRG, so people try to generalize this matrix product state to tensors of this form. In a paper by Sierra and Martin Delgado, they propose it, but nobody uses it except for paper in Nishinen, which they use for classical systems. So they use this kind of tensors as variational state for classical systems to calculate partition functions. In quantum information theory, actually, so we realized at some point that this description was very useful to describe what is called as measurement-based quantum computation. So in fact, you can understand this measurement-based quantum computation, a way of doing quantum computation, just writing your states in this form and thinking, I'll mention in a second, the thinking that whenever you make a measurement, that something happens with these indices that are down there, and this carries the computation. And in to relate it to efficient descriptions of many body systems, actually this is something that we proposed in this paper, in which we wanted to have a family of states which will fulfill the area law, because we knew at the time that the area law is something that is fulfilled in two dimensions. So these states naturally fulfill the area law and therefore should give good descriptions of many body systems. So at that time we wrote these states in terms of a balanced bond construction, in which if these are the physical spins, the red balls, you make the construction by assuming that you have some auxiliary particles which are in maximally entangled state. These are these auxiliary particles. And then what you do is that you have a map that maps the Hilbert space of the auxiliary particles into the physical particles. And this is how you get, somehow you project out degrees of freedom from these auxiliary particles to the physical particles. And in this way you get this projected entangled pair state. This is what we call projected entangled pair states, because the states can be understood as having entangled pairs in the auxiliary particles and projecting out the physical degrees of freedoms. And what is important is that in two dimensions, also Matt Hastings proved that you have a Hamiltonian with short-range interactions and any arbitrary temperature, then you can describe efficiently the state in terms of these projected entangled pair states. Okay, so in summary, so matrix product states and PEPs, if you have short-range interactions and in one and higher dimensions, at least at finite temperature, then describe well this system. So describe efficiently. You don't need an exponential number of parameters, but a polynomial number of parameters. And this is why, but it writes a little bit our research on this fact here. And also should mention that there are also tensor network states or tensor ways of building states. One of them is this multiscalar normalization ANSAT, and I think that Giffre will talk about that, which are especially suited for critical systems. Okay, so again, so we have these descriptions, these PEPS descriptions. We know that somehow nature, as long as you have short-range interactions, can be described efficiently with those states. So what can we do now? So one of the things that people are looking at is numerical algorithms. So if you give me a Hamiltonian and I want to calculate the ground state of this Hamiltonian or thermal state, then what I can do is a variational calculation with respect to these tensors, and in this way find what is the ground state within this family. And if this family describes well the ground state, which is what was proven, as I mentioned before, for certain cases, then this should give a good description. So this would give rise to numerical algorithms. Yes, so it's any finite temperature, and for short-range interactions, and for spin systems. Spin systems, short-range interactions, finite temperature. And for zero temperature, if it's gap, then you can prove it for the ground state.
This is one question for finite temperature. So for finite temperature, you mean using tensor network to construct the density matrix?
Yeah, that's right. So you have to use a purification. It's a technical point that you can make a purification. This is what Max Hastings proves. Okay, so another question is convergence. So the fact that there exists an efficient description doesn't mean that you can find it. And so, I mean, it's interesting to look at under which conditions you will be able to find this description. Okay, so maybe you can impose some other conditions on your system in such a way that you're able to find it.
So even if your gap, suppose you have fermionic quasi-particles, is that still doable by this method?
Yes, everything that has this condition that I mentioned will be doable by this method. Now the question is what means doable? So if I do numerics, so I mean, when I say that this polynomial in N means polynomial, a polynomial can be a big polynomial, so in practice may be very difficult. And on the other hand, there is this question, so convergence, can you really do the variational calculation? So can you solve the question corresponding to this variational calculation? So that's another topic. Another topic that people look at, and we have been looking at, is physical properties. So if we believe that somehow some states of nature can be described in this form, then it means that a single tensor contains all the properties of your system. So if you have a symmetry in your system, it will be reflected in your tensor. You have a topology, properties in your system, if there are anions, excitations, etc., they should be in this tensor. So we have been looking at what are the properties of this tensor in such a way that all these properties emerge. And finally, so we'll be looking also at some other systems. So for example, fermionic systems, so not just I mentioned spins, but you can do the same thing for fermions or for continuous systems. Frank will talk about that later on, or critical systems, etc., etc. And so what I'm going to do now is to talk very briefly about all these four topics, so what we have been doing during the last year. So tell something about time evolution algorithms, these numerical algorithms, something about the convergence for 1D systems in which you can prove that you can converge, something about symmetries and how topology emerges, and very briefly something about fermions and critical systems.
So my question, if it's gapless in two dimensions, how does capital D scale with n?
What has been proven is that for finite temperature, it scales polynomially.
Zero temperature.
At zero temperature, I think that you have to make, in the paper of Hastings, he proves that at zero temperature, if the density of states scales polynomially with a number of particles, then it scales like n to the power log n. So it's between polynomial and exponential, but this is an upper bound. This is not something that...
The dimension of each tensor, that's what you... The rank of the tensor? What was it?
Yes, this is the rank of the dimension of each of
the rank is just 4.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Right. Okay, so these are the things that have been proven. I mean, it doesn't mean that you can make better bonds or whatever. Anyway, so let me first go to algorithms. So we were looking at time evolution algorithms. So there were many time evolution algorithms developed in the context of DMRG. And so you have here how can one of these algorithms look in this language of tensors. So you have your initial state, this is psi of 0, that you write as a matrix product state. This is for one-dimensional systems. Then you have an evolution operator. And this evolution operator you can decompose also in smaller tensors, as long as you have kind of two-body interactions. So this is all these tensors that are here, up to here. Then you have your observable, which is also a tensor. For example, this would be like the spin operator sigma x in one dimension. And then you will have to have just the complex conjugate corresponding to the ket there. And so it means that in order to calculate, so you start with some initial matrix product state. You have an evolution by certain Hamiltonian, you want to calculate this expectation value. This is given just by the contraction of this tensor. It will give you a number, which is exactly this expectation value, maybe divided by the norm or something like that. And so typically how the algorithms work is that they start contracting these tensors from below. So they start just contracting these tensors and making approximations. And what we thought is that maybe it's better to contract them from the side, from here. And this is what is represented here in order to get this number. And then we realize actually that if you contract them from the side here, then somehow the tensors that you're getting are violating the area law. And you can see it even for very simple systems. But you now fold these tensors, this in this one, to the middle. So you continue to identify this particle and this particle as a big particle, this one, or this tensor as a big tensor. This is what called folding. Then this area law is recovered for certain models. So this should give you a better way of calculating time evolutions. And so with this method, we apply to certain Hamiltonians. And we saw that we can go to times which are factor of 2 longer than the longest times that people were able to calculate time evolution with the previous methods, at least for the system that we tried. And so we applied to the problem of thermalization together with Matt Hastings and Marie-Carmen Bayoun. So we took this algorithm and then consider a non-integrable model of this Hamiltonian in one dimension and consider the evolution of a set of spins on a line, all initially in the same state, in a product state, undergoing an evolution given by this Hamiltonian. And we wanted to see whether the fact that it's not integrable, it means that they thermalize in the sense that if you look at the subset of these spins, the region of this spin, it looks as if they would come after a long time from a thermal state. Okay? That's the problem of thermalization, can be formulated like that. And with this method, what we saw is that actually there are 3 different regimes in thermalization. So there are some initial states, for example, when you have this, all the vectors pointing, all the spins pointing, so spin 1/2 parties in the y direction, then you see thermalization as a function of time. So all expectation values up to 3-body density operators thermalize. You start with spin 1, you don't see thermalization, you see oscillations, But if you calculate the average in time of this oscillation, it's also compatible with the fact that they thermalize, so that we call mixed thermalization, in which the state doesn't thermalize, but the integral over time thermalizes. And when you solve evidence that at least for the times that you could simulate, if you start with some other initial state, then there is no thermalization at all.
Okay, so, that's so what is this picture? What are these pictures?
This is the distance between the reduced density matrix of 3 qubits from the time evolved state to the thermal state as a function of time. And you see that this converges. This one here oscillates, but if you look at the time evolution of the operator, then it converges. And this one, it means that they don't converge. So the reduced density matrix for 3 spins does not converge as a function of time until this time here, up to this time, to the thermal.
So the last case, every spin was pointing in the x.
Exactly. So depending
what if you just took one spin and made it different? I mean,
well, we cannot make claims whether there will be thermalization or not in that case. So with this method, actually, we have to study translational invariant systems. So this is why we studied with all the spins in the same and have a Hamiltonian distance relational invariant.
Do they carry different energies?
Huh? Yes, they have different energies. Yes.
But is it correlated with the...
Yeah. So maybe I wanted to give us an example of how you can use for studying some problems, but maybe not to focus so much in the problem. We can talk about that later on.
What does 0 plus 1 mean on every side or you have?
Every side. It's a product state. All the sides are pointing either in the x direction or in the y direction or in the z direction, and depending where they are pointing, they thermalize or they weakly thermalize or they don't thermalize, at least for the time we're able to run this simulation. Okay, so now the other question is convergence. So what we were able to prove. So the question is now, imagine that somebody gives you a Hamiltonian, a one-dimensional Hamiltonian, and tells you minimize the energy for a matrix product state which has this one dimension D, capital D. Okay, so find the matrix product state with one dimension D, which minimizes the energy, and you have some prescribed error, epsilon. So what we show is actually that there exists an algorithm which is promised to give you the result, the right result, and that scales polynomially with the number of particles and the inverse of the error that you're asking, and it grows exponentially with the dimension of the matrix product state that you're looking at. I mean, this fact that it has to grow exponentially with the number of particles with the dimension is known from results, I mean, related to QMA, et cetera, et cetera, but still gives you a polynomial law in the number of particles. And then now you put this thing together with some common knowledge, so how the, for example, you're looking at the energy density, the thermodynamic limit, and you assume that it converges like 1 over n, and you look at the papers where people use the MRT, and they see that if they have cap systems, this D dimension grows polynomially with the number of logarithmic with the number of particles, then you get that for cap systems, you do this method, the full scale mildly, like 1 over the error to the power polynomial of the logarithm of 1 over the error. So this is a conclusion if you assume some kind of general belief.
Excuse me, what error is in that? Delta is...
So delta is the error in the energy. So the first error was the error in the state. Now you apply it to the error in the energy. So you see that you can get some prescribed error with the time that this case like I will do. Okay, so now other systems. So what you can do is to generalize now this PEPS to fermionic systems. And actually, this was done basically simultaneously by the groups of Giffre and also Frank, ourselves, and Ken Sizer. And so they did it for Merlin, they did it for PEPS, and then later on they also have some kind of unifying approach to that. But it's very simple how you would do this for fermions. If you have this kind of balanced bound picture that I gave you before, the only thing that you have to do is to substitute these auxiliary particles by fermions in an entangled state. So you put real fermionic system, not spin system, as auxiliary particles, and you put a fermionic projection, and then automatically you get that everything works like before. And we believe that even the arguments that Hastings had to prove that, I mean, this case approximate well this concept of spin systems would carry over also to fermionic systems with this construction. And in this paper, we also gave a Hamiltonian for which a fermionic PEPS is a ground state. It's a Hamiltonian for free fermions, in fact.
So, I mean, that means that for the same model, you can either use PEPS or FPEPS. and they'll both approximate the same order accurately.
No, you would use, if this is fermionic system, you would use...
No, what do you mean? Fermion? Let's take a spin system with it. Yes. Okay. Would I want to use FPEPs or PEPs?
PEPs. I will use PEPs for a spin system. And if I have a fermionic system, the problem is that if I rewrite in terms of spins, I will have long-range interactions because of the string of the mode. So all what I said before about short-range interactions does not apply.
So there are spin systems which you believe have fermionic excitations.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I would use PEPs directly.
If you have an FPEPs that's not free, and you construct the parent Hamiltonian, can it happen that the parent Hamiltonian is anyway a free model or something?
Well, this is not a parent Hamiltonian, in fact. So this is not what we understand as a parent. It's a Hamiltonian for which this is a ground state, but it's not frustration free.
Okay.
Are you going to show us Hamiltonian? What's
that?
Are you going to show us
Hamiltonian? No, Hamiltonian on a square lattice which has diagonals, basically.
Square lattice?
This is a square lattice.
Yeah.
In which it's kind of a triangle, I think, because it has different couplings also along the diagonal.
Okay, so it's nearest neighbor.
It's nearest neighbor, and also next neighbor, like a J1, J2 model for spins, something like that. You will have to adjust the coupling.
Is the Hamiltonian made of projectors, sort of sums of projectors?
No, I just give it a free fermion. I mean, a free fermion Hamiltonian on a lattice.
Oh, but with a special...
It's actually critical. Yeah. It has long-range interaction. It has long-range correlation. It's a critical model.
It's bilinear in the fermions.
Yes.
Okay.
Is it gap or?
No. It's not actually. It happens that it's a different talk. So it has a direct point, and this is why we don't violate their laws, etc. Because it has a direct point.
So can you do this say for the Kataev honeycomb model, which is another model that's has.
Well, we haven't done it.
I mean, but presumably this.
Presumably, yes. But it depends. So if it would violate the area law logarithmically, like free fermions do, in two dimensions, and let's say something like a direct point, so the Fermi surface has dimension d minus one, which is the critical dimension, then we cannot do it exactly. So it could be an approximation. If it has dimension d minus 2, then it could happen that we have it exactly. So in the Kitaev model, I don't know if they fulfill the, I mean, they violate the area law or not. Right? So what is the violation? There it is. And then, so if they would have a direct point, then I think that probably you can do that. Well, the other possibility is now to say, well, let's, so we know that in one dimensions, these matrix product states, actually, they don't approximate well, the critical systems. Well, they can approximate, but somehow they are not very well suited. So in order to get an exact ground state of the critical system, the dimension of your bonds here should go to infinite. So one possibility is really to put an infinite dimension there and try to look at systems with infinite dimension there. So this is what we did with Hermann Sierra. So actually, what we substituted is this tensor here, like vertex operators of a conformal field theory, and show that actually then you can get critical systems. And in fact, you can get like exact ground states of inhomogeneous Hamiltonians, Hamiltonians, etc. So one possibility, another way of going is to put here now field theories if you want in these auxiliary bonds instead of just spins.
What's the vacuum? Computing it in
the vacuum
state, right?
Well, it was the conformal field theory corresponding to bosons in the vacuum of the boson. And another thing that Frank will talk is that you can also go to the continuum limit in space and having field theories, not spin systems, but field theories. But I think that Frank will talk about that. Okay, so let me finish talking about some physical properties. And the idea here is, as I told you before, so if you believe that now those states can be approximated by these PEPs, it means, and they are translational invariant, it means that all the physical properties should be encapsulated in a single tensor. So if I give you this single tensor, in principle, you should know whether they have a Hamiltonian for which the ground state, and if this Hamiltonian is degenerate or not, it's capped, there are neonic excitation topology, symmetries, etc. So how do we find out? By looking at these tensors. Or, for example, if there are local symmetries, so your state is invariant under some unitary transformation of this form, a product, a local unitary transformation, then so what are the properties of these tensors? You have topological properties of global symmetries, or what are the properties of these tensors. And this is what we have been often investigated. And for that, it's important to distinguish two different kinds of tensors. So tensors that we call injectable, these PEPs, which we call injective, and the PEPs that we don't call injective. And the definition is the following. So imagine that I have one of these tensors. So imagine that this is spin 1/2. So this dimension of the physical index is 2, spin up, spin down. And they have certain indices here of dimension capital D. So since D is smaller than D to the power 4, the dimension of the physical index, of the space of the physical index, is smaller than the auxiliary index, then it means that if I consider now the tensors corresponding to putting spin up and the tensor corresponding to spin down, they will not span all the space of tensors. But if I start now putting together these tensors, then the dimension of the Hilbert space of the physical index grows with a different exponent as this dimension of the tensors that appear here, because they go like the area and they go like the volume. So at some point, typically what will happen is that you take all possible values. So you start here just putting 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 in all the physical indices and construct a tensor. And 0, 0, 0, 1, another tensor. Then the set of tensors that you get will span the whole space of tensors. And in that case, we call it injective. Okay? So if this happens, we call it injective. And actually, it turns out that this property is very remarkable in the sense that when you have injective, then you know that this matrix product state will be the unique ground state of a Hamiltonian that is local, actually, a series of Hamiltonians which are local. So this injectivity property is related to the uniqueness or the generosity of the ground state of Hamiltonians for which this is the ground state. And this was proven in this paper of Farnes, Nathan-Galley, and Werner, and we also took for higher dimensions, but this also too. Okay, so you can distinguish now tensors for which at some point you span the set of tensors, and tensors for which you never span. And these are injective or non-injective. And one of them are kind of unique ground states, the other one are like degenerate. And another property which is important to study that is what we call the gauge symmetry. So you have a tensor like that, and now you multiply this tensor by a matrix X, and here the inverse, and here the matrix Y and the inverse, then it's very clear that they will give rise to the same state. Because whenever you concatenate these tensors, this Y and this Y minus 1 will cancel here, and so they will give exactly the same thing. So it means that the same state, this state is the same. So there are many tensors which give rise to the same state. You have this possibility. But is this true the opposite? So that's the only way of writing two states, so that there cannot be other tensors which are not transformed in this way. And actually, you find that this is true, then you can have standard forms to write the tensors. You can say, okay, let's all talk the same language. So when we talk about one state in this language, then we can give the same state without having to check physical properties to know that we have state. And as I mentioned in a second, this will have some consequences in symmetries. And in fact, this can be proven for injective PEPs. This was proven in these two papers.
Sorry, Ignacio. Can you go back one slide? Sorry. So what exactly is the claim that you get the same physical wave function?
You have a physical wave function that you can write it with different tensors. The only way...
If it's gauge symmetry.
Exactly.
I see, but that's not saying that it's in the same phase or something.
This is that you can write the same state with many tensors, okay. But all these tensors are related by this transformation.
Okay.
Because it's not obvious actually to prove one. I mean, one is obvious.
Injectivity assumption.
It's because injectivity. This is for injectivity, and then I mean, see, this is true. Then you can use it now to prove properties of your tensors under symmetry. So, for example, you have that whenever you apply some unitary operation to all your tensors, you get the same state. Then you know that the same state has to be related with one of these transformations, and then you find what are the properties that this tensor has to have. And actually, the properties what is written here is that whenever you apply some unitary in this physical index corresponding to some group, some representation of a group, then it's the same as if you apply some other representation of the same group to these physical indices. So somehow, the symmetries in the states are represented in the symmetries in your tensor. Yes, with the same group, but with a different representation acting on these auxiliary indices. And this has applications I don't have time to talk about, because I guess I have a couple of minutes. And so this has applications to Lipschitz matrix theorem. So actually, one can prove for people who know these things, Lipschitz-Matisse theorems and the like, and generalizations for higher dimensions, if you have the formalism of PEPs. So you have PEPs, then you can show that, for example, things are not possible, that you cannot have, that you have an SE2 symmetry, and then this is injective. So this is a semi-integer spin with SE2 symmetry, and that's a unique ground state of a Hamiltonian, which is local. This is not possible. It's very simple to prove like that. Or with your U symmetries, et cetera, et cetera. And so the other case is when you have no injective, so you never reach that by concatenating these tensors, then you can show that then whatever you have, whenever you have a Hamiltonian for which is the ground state, actually it will be degenerate. And so actually what you can show in that case, and in one dimension, we believe that this is two dimensions, but we haven't proved, is that in this case what happens is that your tensor is equal to the same, because it remains invariant when you apply some unitary operations corresponding to some group to the auxiliary indices. And so by using this property actually in one dimension, you can prove that this is true. Then you can have a classification of all possible matrix polarized states that are not injective. So I mean, at the end, the solution is that you have to write the different states, which will be we will spend the degenerate ground state of any local Hamiltonian, will be the matrix for that state, and you will have to put here one of these unitary operations corresponding to the representation of the auxiliary indices, and the degeneracy is equal to the conjugacy classes. So you can have, just by this property, so that if your tensors fulfill certain properties, then you know automatically that they have to be degenerate ground states of any local Hamiltonian, and you can know what is degeneracy. And in two dimensions, you can do something similar, and actually this tells you that now you have the same thing in two dimensions, if you have actually that this tensor fulfills this property that I mentioned before, then you can write, if you have a Hamiltonian that is local for which is the ground state, then it will be degenerate, and you can build all the generic subspace just by putting unitary operations on a line and on a column. And because of this property of the what I mentioned before, actually you can move the line. And if you impose on top of that another property of your tensors, namely that they are isometries, which basically means here that you have access to the virtual particles, then you get topology out. And with that I'm finishing. So in other words, you see that your tensor fulfills this property for a certain group, and at the same time is an isometry, then automatically you have this property. So you have several ground states, the number of ground states you can calculate depending on the conjugacy classes of your group. The ground states are locally indistinguishable, so you make a measurement, somebody gives you ground state, and you make a measurement with one and the other one, all the expectation values will be the same. Now, there exist Wilson loops which move into this ground subspace. Then you have topological entropy, a correction to the area law, which is topological entropy. They are the ground states of some Hamiltonians which are commuting, actually locally commuting. They are fixed points of a renormalization group procedure. You can define a renormalization group procedure, and then there will be fixed points. And they have abelian excitation, which are abelian and non-abelian, depending on your group. And I think that there was a paper very similar by basically at the same time that we posted our paper. So there are certain generalizations. So just summarizing, so if one believes that this tips gives a given efficient description of low energy state, say, of many body systems, then you can develop numerical algorithms and prove when they will work and maybe when they will not. This is what many people here have worked on. You can just look at the physical properties by looking at the tensor, so symmetries, et cetera, representing now symmetries in these tensors. And you can look also maybe some other systems which are not spin one. With that, I would like to finish and thank the chairman for his patience.
Okay, we have time for a few questions.
Can the additional freedom for the, in the non-injective case where you have this gauge symmetry, can you think of that additional freedom as being related to the spontaneously broken symmetry?
Yes, what happens in one dimension that when you can consider you have like O-spin ups and O-spin downs, for example.
Right. Okay.
Yes, but in the case of two dimensions, what happens is that you have topology. So you have new things coming in
right.
that are not present in one dimension.
Okay.
Yeah, again, for this non-degenerative case, whether the degenerate ground state can be constructed by this uniform tensor or non-uniform tensor. We all have degeneracy, whether every state in the degenerate subspace can be expressed as a uniform tensor Heisenberg state, or you need to...
Actually, there is, I mean, in this way, it will not, because you need the line of unitaries, but it has been proven now by some people in the group in Garfield, by Miguel Aguado and with other people, that in fact you can write it, all of them, as for all double models, I think, that all of them can be written like, if they are translation invariant, with the same tensors.
I see.
I haven't seen them, I have the claim.
I see.
Okay.
Okay, so thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for the kind invitation and for the effort and pain of setting up this very nice workshop on emergence and entanglement. And in fact, this talk will at least be a lot about entanglement when we are concerned with grasping quantum many-body systems in terms of tensor networks. So when I looked at the program late last week, I thought, oops, this is essentially the same title as Ignacio has submitted. But, well, this is not so much bad news as rather good news, and that what we are going to look at should rather nicely complement what Ignacio has said just a minute ago, and what is more, is given a great, Stan already a great job introducing a number of concepts that will be helpful later. So just think of this talk as describing description of quantum many-body systems using MPS caps and other families of states part 2 as the sequel of the nice movie that Ignacio has already presented. So this is an early talk in this workshop, so I do have some introductory material, forgive me, and I might anyway just quickly go over these things, so let's see how this works. So clearly the usual suspects that we have in mind throughout this talk will be, well, unsurprisingly, quantum many-body systems with a local Hamiltonian. So we think of just having a lattice given, some meaningful physical lattice that's dictated by the physics of the problem. And we have a quantum degree of freedom per lattice side, like a spin or a fermionic or a bosonic degree of freedom. Just say spin sitting on each side. Usually in such a situation, not everybody is coupled to everybody, but systems directly interact only with finitely many neighbors, say nearest neighbors, hence.